couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Killers of the Flower Moon, The Fall of the House of Usher, Goosebumps, and the Roald Dahl short films on Netflix. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Night of the Demons and Night of the Demons 2. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@thatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Before I get to the news, I do want to talk about something. I've got this plane in the magical studio in the sky, the streaming service Tubi. And I've talked about Tubi in the past. I love Tubi. I think it's owned partially by Fox, which means it's under the Disney umbrella. And it's free. It doesn't cost anything, and everything's supported by ads, so you don't have to deal with ads. But it has some incredible stuff on there, especially nostalgic stuff. If you're looking for old TV shows like I Dream of Jeannie, or I remember I was watching The Ropers on that a couple months ago, it has all that kind of stuff, and it has like a bunch of British television shows. It's got a lot of older stuff, whereas something, you know, like Netflix tends to be much more contemporary. But if you want some nostalgic stuff, check out Tubi. And the thing that I've been enjoying is they have this thing called the Halloween Lounge, which is, I think there's like three episodes of it. And it's like 2 hours each episode of just Halloween-themed imagery and Halloween-themed music. And right now I've got playing in the magical studio in the sky. I've got it going on, and they've got this glowing jack-o'-lantern with smoke coming out of its eyes. And it looks really, really cool. Now, if you play some Halloween music in the background, you don't have to listen to their music. Just mute your TV or turn off your soundbar or something and then play whatever Halloween music you want. But it's great for the atmosphere as you're leading up to the Halloween holiday in a couple weeks. Now, the news I want to talk about is last week, the box office, Taylor Swift, of course, dominated. That was no surprise. Everybody expected that to happen. Taylor Swift's The Eras Tour made $93 million over the weekend, which, first of all, before I start doing the sour grapes of the studios, that's an amazing number. First of all, you got to understand, she didn't advertise this. There was no advertising for this at all. This was essentially just an announcement she made on her social media, and she sold $93 million worth of tickets. That's amazing. That's the highest grossing concert movie ever, just in 1 week. Bigger than any other concert movie they've ever had. Also because she only announced it like a couple weeks ago. It wasn't like this was expected for a year or two. Nobody was expecting her to do this. And it came up as an opportunity for people who hadn't seen the Eras Tour to go see it. Now, the big thing that's being reported is people are like, oh, they were thinking $100 million, but she didn't make $100 million. That's like somebody getting a job out of college and they say, we are going to pay you $950,000 a year. And then somebody go, well, you didn't get $1 million a year for your first job offer. And that's just stupid. $93 million for a concert tour is phenomenal, especially when you consider the pay structure that she put together with the theaters to do it. Now, The Hollywood Reporter had a really interesting article that I was looking through this week, and it talks about how the studio was sort of negging her on doing this and saying, well, you didn't hit your $100 million. You left money on the table. And I hate that saying. I hate that expression, because the whole concept of leaving money on the table is precluded by the fact that you are assuming that that money would be there. Usually when somebody says, oh, you left money on the table, it's a woulda, coulda, shoulda. They said you left money on the table for a deal that didn't happen. If you would have done it this way, it would have resulted in more money. But we have no proof that if you would have done it this way. I'm just making some sort of wild speculation. And that's what that phrase means to me. I think it's a BS phrase. And like the studios were saying, well, you know, they complained about the problems that they had. And there were some problems with the marketing of this, mainly things like they added shows at the last minute, and some people were upset because they couldn't change their tickets from Friday to Thursday, and some of the Thursday shows weren't as full. And then there was a big debate, and this is still going on, about whether people should have been allowed to get up and dance and sing and take pictures with their phones and be raucous and crazy like a concert. And it's a concert film. And this wasn't even like a concert film slash documentary. As I understand, I didn't see it, but as I get it, it was a concert film. It was her music. It was like going to the concert. So yeah, get up and dance for something like this. Don't get up and dance when you're watching Killers of the Flower Moon or something like that, but get up and dance during the Taylor Swift movie. So the studios are sort of like nitpicking that stuff. Well, here's the thing. Maybe she would have cracked $100 million with studio intervention and studio might of marketing behind it. But how much would that A, have cost marketing? Oh, if you would have spent $10 million more marketing it, you would have made $5 million more over the weekend. Or even more so, the studio would have taken probably 10 to 15% at least, unless the studio would work out a bigger deal. Generally, the studio takes a lot out of that first weekend of the film. So even if it only got like 10 or 15%, if it would have just cracked $100 million, they're still ahead by not paying that fee to the studio. All that $100 million is bragging rights to say I cracked the century mark. But in reality, who cares? Taylor Swift made a bundle off of this, and she was a genius in how she set this up, or her family was. I just think it's sour grapes from the studios, and the studios just need to go lick their own wounds. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. I got two movies in the trailer park that are coming to streaming, and the first one I want to talk about is Leo, and that's coming to Netflix on November 17th.
No animal wants to be locked up. I wasted my life!
This year, every student has to take home a class pet.
This is my shot!
Are you nuts?
So I go with these kids, then I escape, and then I really live. It's on. Mother of Godzilla!
What was that? You just spoke! Mom!
No!
You talk!
No!
You're
people can't know!
This is an animated film about an iguana that basically escapes from its school pet habitat. It's voiced by Adam Sandler, so you got all the Adam Sandler people in it. And it's meant to be absurd and silly and uplifting and cute. And I mean, actually, it doesn't look bad. It does feel like it's going to be just loaded with Adam Sandler humor. Now, I respect the heck out of Adam Sandler. Just like the Taylor Swift thing. Adam Sandler's movies on Netflix aren't bringing in huge numbers. He's not getting box office numbers, but he's getting paid. He's being able to make the art that he wants to make. And you may not like it, but he's doing what he wants to do. And there's a certain popularity about it. So what if he doesn't have a number that he can brag about for a box office? He's getting paid. And that's the important point on something like this. This one, it might be kind of cool. I don't know. We'll see. It looks like it's just going to be cute. But that'll be coming to Netflix. The other one, Candy Cane Lane, is coming to Prime on December 1st.
What was your Christmas wish?
I just want it to be the best Christmas ever.
Oh, ignore all the fine print. Honestly, it's like you're signing your life away.
This is crazy.
Hold up, that was your wish? Not like, I don't know, world peace?
End hunger.
End homelessness.
Stop climate change.
Save the polar bears.
New Drake album.
Oh, I love Drake.
Point taken.
This is, of course, an Eddie Murphy movie. It's basically him making a wish at a Christmas store that he has the best Christmas ever, and somehow basically gives him the 12 days of Christmas. I don't know. It's very vague. The trailer doesn't really specify what happens. It's not a good trailer. It's a confusing trailer. And you've got Julian Bell playing, I guess, like a fairy godmother or the devil. I don't know who she plays. It seems like she's trying to do something evil in a Christmas atmosphere. I am very confused by this. And I have a feeling that the movie's going to be making about as much sense. And with that, I need to go make some money and come back, and then I'll be talking about The Fall of the House of Usher and the Roald Dahl short films on Netflix. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews, and we're going to kick things off with a scary piece, and that is The Fall of the House of Usher. I know this came out last week, but there's so many things to cover. I can only cover so much, and I'm kind of like running about a week behind on certain things. And I also wanted to take the time to watch at least enough episodes of this, because there's eight, so it's an eight-hour commitment. And I'm about five through, and that's enough to really get a feel of this. But anyways, the Fall of the House of Usher is a new series on Netflix from Mike Flanagan. The family members behind a morally questionable pharma company meet a grisly end.
Roderick Usher, your family is a collection of stunted hearts. Whose time has come?
Who are you?
Consequence. Is consequential.
This was no accident. You have been targeted. And this woman knows everything.
It's time, Roderick.
I'm afraid you're ringside for my reckoning, old friend.
I'm not a huge Mike Flanagan fan. That goes back to his early stuff. His independent film, Abstentia, I was not a huge fan of. I know a lot of people went goo-goo over it. And in fact, I actually critiqued it on Twitter, and he yelled at me. I still got the tweet captured somewhere. I mean, this was like 10 years ago, and he was grumpy at me. Now he's a big name, and so he's, you know, who cares at this point? He doesn't care what a fat guy from Ohio has to say. But, I mean, there's some of his stuff I've liked. I think his Stephen King stuff's good. I think that, like, Gerald's Game was a good adaptation. I liked what he did with Dr. Sleep. I like the fact that he gets a group of people together that he likes and uses them as his recurring cast. One of them happens to be his wife, but, you know, hey, that's fine. But his other films, you know, like Hush, I was sort of on Hush, partly because I'm not a huge home invasion fan. And I respect some of the things he did. Like with Hush, I respect giving the idea of a deaf person's perspective of a home invasion. I think that was an interesting approach to a film like that. But he's become really well known for the stuff he's done on Netflix. Stuff like The Haunting of Hill House, The Haunting of Bly Manor. Or, what is it, Midnight Mass. I've not even watched that one. And I respect what he does with these because I love the fact that somebody's cultivating a legacy of horror. And I love the fact that he's brought in somebody like Henry Thomas, who for years was just the kid from E.T., but he's really giving him a chance to shine and play multiple different characters, especially in The House of Usher. But I've never really liked those shows. I don't know. They seem kind of bloated and overwritten. I mean, there's a simplicity to Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House that he kind of tramples on, in my opinion. So I've not been a huge fan of those. I've never finished watching those. But I got to say, I'm really intrigued by The Fall of the House of Usher. Because it's not a recreation of the original story by Edgar Allan Poe. It's more a love letter to Poe. The whole show is a love letter to Poe. And he takes elements from Edgar Allan Poe and he kind of just crams them together in this long form limited series on Netflix. The stuff with Edgar Allan Poe deals with death and loss, and there's multiple stories where people get buried or locked up or built into a wall somewhere. I mean, there's literally several stories that have that happen. And it's about guilt and the negative emotions of life coming after. That's what Poe's stuff is about. And Poe's stuff's very, very dark. And I have to say, I really enjoy this because what it does is every episode is named after and based on one of Poe's stories. And I mean, it's not a adaptation of it, but it plays off of it, like The Murder of the Rue Morgue or The Cask of Amontillado. And they play off of what happens in those stories. If you know your Poe, and it's very clear that Flanagan knows his Poe. And they have all these little Easter eggs of references to different things, you know, everything from Goldbug to Fortunato and these names that show up throughout Poe. And it's this story of greed and avarice and consequences to that. And maybe not in real life consequences, but certainly a spiritual consequence to that. And it does play off of the opioid crisis. We got a lot of those, what, Dope Sick and stuff like that on other networks. Everybody's done their own story about the opioid crisis, because the whole thing, the genesis to why their house is falling is because they over-marketed their opioid that caused a lot of addiction and deaths and that sort of thing. but this is actually really brilliantly put together and very stark and very grisly. And it really exists in this gray area because you really root for whatever the spirit of vengeance played by Carla Gugino, and you root for her and you root against the people in the family. Each episode details one of their demises, and Bruce Greenwood plays the patriarch of the whole thing. And he's quite brilliant in it because he is this sleazy businessman, but he had noble beginnings and he had uplifting beginnings. And he's kind of a good guy trapped in a bad guy's skin. And he still does a lot of bad things, but there's a core of him trying to do good, even if it's misdirected. So there's a lot of layers to this. I mean, this is it's a respectful patchwork of Edgar Allan Poe's stories and tropes, but this miniseries tackles something more complex than just that. I'm going to have to say The Fall of the House of Usher totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some of the Roald Dahl short films. Short stories by Roald Dahl were adapted for the screen using Wes Anderson's signature style.
He was lying on his back with a single sheet covering three quarters of his body. He was wearing a pair of striped pajamas and sweating terribly. It was a hot night. I was sweating myself, but not like Harry. His whole face was wet and the pillow was soaked. It looked like malaria to me. What is it, Harry?
Crite.
What?
Crite.
Crite?
Snake.
You've been bitten by a crite? Where? How long ago?
How?
What?
Didn't bite yet.
That confused me. I gave Harry a funny look.
Cried on stomach, asleep.
That was just a clip from one of the episodes. It's called Poison. And you got Poison, the Rat Catcher, and the Swan. Those are the three stories. Now, I talked about the wonderful story of Henry Sugar a couple weeks ago. That's a more in-depth, layered story. That's a longer form. It's about 40 minutes. All of these are about 15 minutes long. And they're based on short stories that Dahl had written, but they're not kids' stories. He's not doing Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Matilda. He's doing something a little heavier, a little more adult, we'll say. And each one of those, like the Poison, it's about a guy who thinks there's a snake on his chest and these people are trying to save him. The Rat Catcher is these people of this town hiring a rat catcher and learning more about it and sort of his weirdness to it. And the Swan is the story of this kid being bullied at school. So they deal with more mature subject matter, but these three, as compared to Henry Sugar, are much simpler. And because they're simpler, you've got that style that Wes Anderson does. That and I'm not going to say symmetrical because the stuff's not. It's just rigid in a lot of ways, and it feels like it's more paper dolls, even when it's real people, but there's a charm to it. And all three of these are great. It takes about an hour to watch them, and it's really a great little section together. It's funny, because I was talking to this publicist from Netflix, and I was telling him how much I loved Henry Sugar, and I said, one of the other ones coming out, he goes, they're on there. He's like, go to the service. And I'm so depressed that they didn't bring these out with much more fanfare, because they deserve it so much more. I'm going to say these short films rock.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Killers of the Flower Moon and Goosebumps. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews and talk about the big movie of the weekend, Killers of the Flower Moon. After World War I, someone is killing the members of the Osage Nation who have mineral rights to oil-rich land on the reservation.
Well, we mix these families together, and that estate money flows the right direction. It'll come to us.
Shumikasi, that's how you are.
I don't know what you said, but it must have been Indian for handsome devil.
Why did you come here?
I work with my uncle.
You scared of him?
Oh, he's the nicest man in the world.
Little background on this. This is a production with Apple TV+, and it's also Paramount. And originally, I believe this was going to do kind of what Emancipation did in a lot of the other movies that they have for Apple TV Plus. And I thought it was just going to get a limited 2-week run in theaters and then go right to their streaming services. But as I understand, this is getting a full blown theatrical release. And then later this year, probably closer as we get deeper into award season, it's going to be available at home to watch on Apple TV Plus. And that's fine. I mean, I know there's some people that are like, theatrical or die! But I don't care. I mean, it looks great on the big screen. I will say that. I mean, it is a big screen movie. And I find it odd that somebody like Scorsese, who's all about film and projection, has done his last two movies have been with online services, basically. I mean, Netflix with The Irishman, and this one's Apple TV Plus. I mean, I don't know why he's doing these deals if he's such a purist. I mean, you know, I think he's going where the money is, because apparently this thing costs $200 million. But the true story about these murders that were happening, and at first they were like mysterious deaths, but no, they were bona fide murders. And the whole thing is there's this reservation, and like I said, it's based on a true story in Oklahoma where they struck oil, and it happened to be an Indian reservation, and that meant that the Indians owned the land. So they suddenly got very, very rich over the land and mineral rights. But there were some people who got into this, and they kind of hatched a plan, and they say, you know, if we marry into this family, those monies will start to flow towards us. And weirdly enough, some of the key members, the full-blooded Osage, who had the most claim to the land, were getting killed. And because they're Indians, the American government really didn't care that much. Certainly the local government didn't care. But this is a very, very slow burn, and it's ultimately a crime thriller. Courtroom drama near the end, because they eventually bring in the authorities into this. But it takes its time to get there, and that's because it's Scorsese. Now, Scorsese's in his 70s or 80s, and he's old. And if you watched The Irishman, I loved The Irishman. But The Irishman's a slow burn. This is a slow burn, too. It's 3.5 hours. I felt this had a better pacing than The Irishman, mainly because The Irishman was broken up into eras. And this is telling a consistent story, even though it takes place over several years. But it's very well done. And one of the most brilliant things about this is the main characters, Leonardo DiCaprio, who weirdly channels Carl from Sling Blade. You know, so I talk like this all the time. He doesn't quite do, but he's doggone close. Still, I think he does a good job. And Robert De Niro, those are the two main stars. But they also got a bunch of other people in the, Jesse Plemons shows up in this, John Lithgow, Academy Award winner Brendan Fraser shows up in this too. But De Niro and DiCaprio are the anchors for this. And they're very good at acting as you would expect. But their characters, they're not good people. They are bad people. And it takes a while to acclimate to that, because as you're watching, you're just so conditioned in watching movies that the people that are main characters you're supposed to root for. You're supposed to get behind them. And that's kind of what Scorsese did with The Irishman. The Irishman is about a guy who just indiscriminately kills people and had done that ever since he was in Vietnam. And in watching this film, I realized that he kind of followed the same thing. Like, there's this great scene near the end of The Irishman where it's at the guy's end of his life and a priest is there trying to wring out of him his guilt. Just come clean and I can absolve you of your sins, but you have to admit that they're sins first. And he just won't do it because he's a bad person who doesn't realize what he was doing was wrong. And that's kind of what you get here with the complexity of these characters. And that's there's a truth to that, because there's a lot of people in this world. There are good people and there are bad people. And there are bad people who sometimes do good things. And there are good people who sometimes do bad things. But you also have to remember that there are bad people who still do bad things. But the bad people do not see themselves as the bad guys. And that's essentially what you've got going on in this one. It's about the bad guys, and not the way gangster stories are about the bad guys. But as much as De Niro and DiCaprio command the movie, Lily Gladstone, who plays the Osage woman that Leonardo DiCaprio marries, she goes head to head with these guys. I mean, that's got to be intimidating to just walk in and be like, oh, yeah, by the way, you're a relatively unknown actor. and you're going to be up against DiCaprio and De Niro in almost every scene you do. That's intimidating, but she just knocks it out of the park. She commands in a very slow, quiet, stoic way, which is part of the way the character is. I really enjoyed this. And it's long. I know it's long. Go to the bathroom first. You know, this is classic Martin Scorsese slow burn with complex understanding relationship, and it makes for a gripping film. Killers of the Flower Moon totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm doing another late one. Goosebumps, which started out as a book series by R.L. Stine, who's from Columbus, Ohio, my hometown. And they did a bunch of TV series. They did a TV series on like Nickelodeon. It was very low rent. And my kids would watch some of those episodes. And it's great sort of scary story for grade school kids. I mean, like normal grade school kids, not like me. When I was a grade school kid, I was watching harder stuff, but that's just me. But for just regular grade school kids. And they did a couple movies with Jack Black. They did Goosebumps 1 and 2, and those did okay in the theaters. But they decided to do a TV series, and it's on Disney Plus. In a small town, the skeleton in the closet of the parents awakens to threaten their high school children.
Have we met?
Nathan Bratt, I'm the new English teacher.
You live near here?
Yeah, the old Biddle house. I did hear the horrible story about the boy who used to live there.
You know, I hear it's haunted. Have you seen anything strange happening there?
Some weird stuff has been happening.
Something's clearly wrong.
This is all connected. He's getting revenge for what our parents did to him.
This one skews a little older. I mean, it goes for probably junior high age. It's high school kids, but a lot of middle school kids will read and watch movies about high school kids. That's sort of like the rule. You look at the next generation up is what you read about. And it's a little darker and a little heavier and a little more grounded. It's not as goofy and silly and quickly cheesy as the original series was. And so they've written a greater story around this. And, you know, it follows that whole sins of the parents type story. And we've seen that before. It feels like it's a sequel series, but it's not. I guess it isn't. And it does draw from some of the episodes and tropes and characters. I know Slappy, the ventriloquist dummy, shows up, and they've got the Say Cheese with the haunted camera. So they do bring in elements from R.L. Stine's books. But at its core, it's really more of just a middle school, high school drama about kids who are threatened by essentially a ghost. I mean, there's some stuff I like about it. I mean, I like the setup. I would have probably liked this a lot if I were a middle school kid. It's just a little bit too middle school-y for me. I mean, it skews toward an older audience than the books or the classic series, but this does offer an interesting, if not drawn-out, creepy story. And I say drawn-out because they're like hour-long episodes, and they feel like they should be about half-hour episodes. I mean, if Disney's making half-hour episodes for the Marvel and the Star Wars series, you can make half-hour Goosebumps episodes. These just seem a little bloated at times. But still, it works for what it is. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about two discs that you can get, Night of the Demons on 4K and Night of the Demons 2 on Blu-ray. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move into the home cinema segment because we're going to be talking about some physical media. By the way, did you see the news that Best Buy is going to stop physical media? I mean, that's fine. It's a big chain store. I can't imagine they make a lot of money on people buying physical discs. My kids work at a Best Buy, and they're like, there's this one guy, I forget his name, but apparently he shows up there every week looking for new releases on Blu-ray and DVD. And they've gotten to know who this guy is. He just shows up every week. He gets it, you know, and I mean, I don't know if he's getting the best deal, but this guy's going to be really disappointed. But let me just point out that just because Best Buy is not going to be selling DVDs and Blu-rays and 4Ks anymore does not mean that DVDs and Blu-rays and 4Ks don't exist. And then you can still get them. You're just not going to be able to go to Best Buy and get them. So you probably are having less options of places to go. I imagine Walmart still has them. And sure, you can go onto Amazon or whatever and find almost anything, really. If it's sold somewhere, they're making it. This does not mean people are going to stop making the discs. But, you know, one of the places that does still make the discs is Scream Factory. And they've been doing a lot of old vintage releases. And the latest vintage release for October, I'm a couple weeks late on this just because, again, schedule and stuff. But they've got some a double feature, actually a triple feature, but I only got the two discs. Right now, that sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on two of them, and they're both from the same series, Night of the Demons, which is a horror franchise that goes from the 80s into the 90s. I'm going to start off with the first one, which is available in 4K. It's a slasher movie, but with demons instead of a guy with a knife. But let's talk about Night of the Demons, the first one, which came out in 1988. Night of the Demons, a high school misfit throws a party at a deserted house and unleashes demons on all her friends. Oops.
A spooky, deserted mansion. Halloween night.
All right, dudes. Let's party!
10 kids. Now, as long as they live, they'll wonder what's gotten into them.
I think I'd seen it a couple years ago, but I ever since I was in high school, and I'd see it at the video store. I never saw it in theaters, but I'd see the video store release, and it always had this the picture of the demon. It's her with the monstrous face and a birthday invitation. And there were movies that were always like the one I never rented, the one I always ended up finding something else to rent. But I always had Night of the Demons as a choice, as a backup, but I always had found something else. So I'd probably seen it about less than 10 years ago. So it was nice to go back and revisit it. And it's essentially a cheesy 80s movie, but it was at the time, you know, by the time you got into the late 80s with horror movies, they started to put in heavy metal soundtracks. You got that a lot with the Nightmare on Elm Street movie. And then of course, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, especially the sequels. And then like when Wes Craven did that with the movie Shocker, which came out, that was like 1988 or 90 or something like that. Because there was this weird connection where there was a satanic panic going on where people were like, oh gosh, kids are listening to backmasking music and they're turning into psychopaths. And that's all nonsense. It's not true. I mean, people did try and backmask stuff because once they found out people were worried about it, they put it in there and then kids would get it and try and figure out what the hidden message was, even though it was all nonsense. But this Night of the Demons really plays off of that. But at its core, it's just a slasher movie. And it stars like Lilliana Quigley's in it. She's 30 playing a high school kid, but that's okay. And you know, she does what she did in the 80s. She was a scream queen. She'd take off her clothes. She looked great and she'd scream and then violence would happen. And you know, she had makeup effects done and everything. The Night of the Demons is fun. I mean, it's silly, but it's... What I find fascinating about it is it takes all the tropes of a slasher movie and just applies it to a possession movie. And I think that's what makes it successful. And the 4K, well, the 4K comes with the Blu-ray. And that's where all the special features are. And I'll tell you, I mean, it has a bunch of audio commentaries. It has a bunch of behind the scenes thing. Shout Factory does a great job with putting together all the extra features and the special stuff that goes along with it, because they got interviews with the cast, the remaining cast, and some alternate scenes and theatrical trailers, promo spots, all this kind of stuff. They got work prints and changes, all the different things that they did with the movie along the way. So it's a great 4K to get, especially if you like that series. It's the best of the series. I mean, a classic 80s style slasher works as a possession film, playing off the sex, drugs, and rock and roll scares of its era. I'm going to say that Night of the Demons kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Whenever there is a big movie, especially a horror film in the 80s, which were very cheap to make, and this one, these movies were cheap to make because it was just a lot of makeup and lighting effects, and they were all essentially, you know, just very limited locations. So if you have a low-budget horror film that does well, you're going to make a sequel, and so they made Night of the Demons 2. Years after A Night of Violence, more teenage shenanigans leads to the release of more demons on a small town.
For too long, your nights have been empty. You've waited alone in the dark for the very last time. Angela is inviting you back to Hull House.
Oh, Angela! Your party guests are here!
To celebrate her homecoming party.
What's funny about this movie is it stars Christine Taylor, best known as Mrs. Ben Stiller, early in her career. This is before she even, I think, did the Brady Bunch movie, or it might have been right around the time she did the Brady Bunch movie playing Marcia. So this is essentially the same kind of movie. They revisit it, the kids at the school, it's become a legend. What happened in the first movie? Because this is about 6 years later, at least that's what was made 6 years later. And then they go and try and invite Angela to her birthday party. And of course they unleash demons, because that's what happens in these films. And so essentially it follows the same trajectory. It's a slasher movie. But instead of a guy with a hockey mask and some sharp objects, it's this possession. But they are playing, like you do with any sort of sequel or series, you want to make the main antagonist, you want to make them iconic. And they were doing their best to build Angela as the next Freddy Krueger. It never quite clicked. It's a little bit late in doing it because the Scream was able to start and bring in an iconic character, but I don't think you had any really iconic characters after Freddy Krueger. I mean, you had Michael Myers, and then you had Jason, and then you had Freddy Krueger. And by that point, they were trying, everybody was trying to make something iconic. And it worked for the fans of the series. You'd have this character of Angela, and played by Amelia Kincaid. And by this point, she's like 30, like I said. And she's game for it. It's fun. I mean, it's a fun slasher type movie. And I think it does get some points because it goes in some different places. It's not just a retread of the first film. They try to build up some lore, and they try to build up some connections from some of the characters. And it's a little trite, and it's a little goofy, and not everything works, and not everything makes total internal sense. But I like the fact that they weren't just trying to redo the first film. I mean, as much as they do kind of redo the first film. But like the other Shout Factory stuff, this Blu-ray, because it's only available on Blu-ray, they don't have a 4K of Night of the Demons 2. They've got some great stuff in here. They've got more audio commentaries. They've got a new transfer of the film. And they've got behind-the-scenes interviews with the actors and the filmmakers. It's not as flush with the special features because, I mean, it doesn't go as deep. This was a smaller movie, and it was more, by that time, 94, the slasher films had kind of waned a bit. You hadn't had Scream revitalize and update the slasher franchise. This kind of fit in the middle, where they had done all the regular slashers, and now this was more supernatural slashers, and then they do the throwback stuff, and a new breed of stuff with Kevin Williamson and Wes Craven. But still, I mean, this isn't a bad little movie. I enjoyed it. As a horror fan, this was one I had never seen before. So it was nice to mark that off my bucket list. So it's not as strong as the original film, but this is a worthy sequel with some slasher tropes. I'm going to say that Night of the Demons 2 also kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it. I gotta go. Next week I'm going to be talking about the next horror film coming out, which is Five Nights at Freddy's. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.